I'm Brendan McGee, and you're listening to Revisitation, a creative nonfiction program exploring the relationship between motion and self-discovery. On June 19th, 2013, David Hashey made national headlines washing ashore near Majorville, New Brunswick, after a days-long river cruise on a dock he'd stolen from the Fredericton Rowing Club. Over the last several years, I've interviewed a dozen people trying to make sense of this local news sensation, all while searching for the man himself. Every song you'll hear is tied to our story's setting, the Wolastoq River, often called by its settler name, the St. John. You'll find more information about the podcast, as well as links to stream and purchase these songs at revisitationpodcast.wordpress.com. Saturday, 22nd June, 2013. Mills Convenience Store. Juniper.
And just being down by the water is very, very meaningful.
I first heard David Hashey's story exactly 1 week after he'd set out, in Juniper, New Brunswick, of all places. We'd driven to town late that morning from the Wright family cottage, some ways off of Juniper Road, where waving to each passing car is custom. Our windows conjured municipal landmarks, like the organics plant, which rose from the ashes of a 2010 mill closure that devastated this region. There was some talk of the Pentecostal church up the road, and curiosity at what wonders resided in the hamlet's poorhouse bar. Beneath us, light brown dirt became vapor, hanging up in that humid air so replete with mosquitoes and horseflies. The June bugs had come and gone early that year, as I recall. At Mills Convenience Store, cloaked in a newfound anonymity afforded by the 100 kilometers between us and our parents' friends, we splurged, in cliched form, on cheap fireworks and even cheaper cigars. I can't remember who snatched up that June 21st edition of the local Daily Gleaner, and I also can't be sure of why. When an afternoon breeze rose to ward off the insects, we sat around a rotting wooden deck outside the cottage. I'd earlier slipped in the water and rolled an ankle there at the lower end of the Southeast Miramichi River, causing me to hobble quite profoundly. Chris was merrily crushing a few empty cans with a found metal shovel, but stopped to join us on the deck as the story was narrated in appropriate tenor. Unfamiliar with the formality, I inhaled my cigar harshly, peppering our bewildered laughter with a fit of coughs. Though I can't recall if we bought that paper because of Hashey, both story and subject endeared themselves to us immediately, true to the nature of a weekend with friends in the middle of the woods. There was something to the restlessness we all felt in our early 20s and our unwillingness to accept it as passable. Whether guided by a burning bush or an empty case of James Reddy, Hashey's journey spoke equally to the absurdity of conviction and the danger of boredom. Back home in Fredericton, we scoured the news footage religiously and spread that gospel at parties and in workplaces to folks with varying degrees of interest. Friends from that time who've since moved away or fallen out of touch will, on the occasion of reunion, remind us of David Hashey, as they do with the dive bar we worshipped, or the other en vogue bits of the time. And while the doors of the library lounge remain shut, and the four of us have spread out across this country of regions, I always felt as though David Hashey would come ashore in our lives once again. Revisitation will return after this.
Stream a torrent, the highway bridges that run high.
That's The Weather Station with Floodplain. Written after songwriter Tamara Lindemann observed the flooded-out Wolastic River during a tour of the Maritimes some years back. I didn't feel I could go much further without talking to my fellow co-authors of this mythology.
Hello again?
Hello.
And so, a FaceTime call was arranged between Halifax, Montreal, Toronto, and mid-February New Orleans.
Ryan O'Toole.
David Cheney.
Chris, can you do yours again?
Sure. Yeah, Chris Balcom.
Cool.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Whose family's in the background? Right. Which one of you has a bunch of kids now?
I'm on the sidewalk where Mardi Gras revelers are packing.
After many happy stops and starts, together, we pooled our memories. Do you remember how we first would have heard about the dock theft or Hashi himself?
I remember people like talking about it, like coworkers and so on. And everybody was all like, who would steal a dock from the rowing club? It was a bit of a mystery. And people were surprisingly worked up about it, I thought.
Right.
But I remember we found out about the Hashi story specifically, when we were in Juniper, I think I got a gleaner at the whatever it is that store. And we went in for
supplies.
Yeah,
was it the gleaner or the post or something?
It was one of the Irving papers, unfortunately. I don't endorse the Irving family. Let that be known on the podcast. But it was just a great story, you know? There was so many amazing quotes in it. And I think we were all, you know, a bit, you know, we had some drinks and we had some good laughs about the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, the paper had an image of him with his long, sort of shiny white hair and long beard. And he's quoted throughout the short article. Well, I believe the final quote that the article ends with is, "I'm going to smoke weed till the day I die."
What really did it for me was the image of him. And I think he's either getting out of a police car, going into a police car, and he looks almost biblical, like he looks like a Greek god or something.
He's
this towering figure, and you can feel his energy like through the image. It's amazing. And then you read the quotes and you find out that he's just this gentle soul who is a very lonely man, mm-hmm. who just wanted to make a memory for himself, basically. And then it becomes mm-hmm. this really beautiful tale.
What do you guys remember of that weekend in Juniper? That was the first of two trips I think we made.
You know, it's a beautiful part of New Brunswick that not many people in the province find any reason to go there. We were like sitting out on this porch on the river with this newspaper, just circling back to it over and over again and going over the quotes and marveling and sort of laughing because it was funny, but also being like touched by it. And like, it's such a unique story. So I think we had spent the better part of the afternoon talking about it.
This truly became a bit, like, albeit a bit that's in good faith for us, something we still talk about with the same energy that we did 7 years ago. But what, if anything, does he symbolize to us?
There was, like, coverage of the story when it was still some kind of, like, mystery that, you know, in Fredericton, you can get a fair bit of mileage out of that, I feel like, in a slow news week. But then, like, the story, when it came out, you know, what had happened. This guy, this character, having a three-day kind of sojourn down the river, I think it... Yeah. We probably weren't alone in having our kind of imaginations captured by that to some extent, you know? It was a really... Mm-hmm. touching story. It's kind of quite a beautiful one.
You know, these are these small town news outlets. Extreme weather is a story, but you'd be hard pressed to find a story in the Daily Gleaner that is so touching or interesting. So it was also special in that way.
Because we were all very surprised to find such a story. I remember we really wanted to like hang out with him because I think we were maybe trying to, you know, achieve similar things. I think this was just a man who wanted to go on vacation.
And I wonder if we could speculate now as to like what we would have said or what that conversation might have been like.
Well, I'm not really sure. I think it's one of those things that you imagine a certain way and it would probably be very different, to be honest. I don't know if I would have... what I would have really told him. Because, you know, we had also talked quite a bit about how we, who knows what this person is actually
yes.
like. It's possible that he was someone that we wouldn't have actually been that inspired by. All we have is the story.
I mean, I would have liked to say, you know, just that, I mean, his story was really touching. And I think it did, you know, really mean something genuine to us. And I don't know,
maybe
he would have appreciated hearing that. Maybe he wouldn't have, but.
Right.
I think it's certainly true, you know, and I think it's, I think he brought joy to people through this.
Definitely.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think maybe he would have liked to have heard that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
I would have just told him that, you know, in making his own memory, he made memories for us, obviously, which is very corny, but it's true.
It's absolutely true. Yeah.
It became like, something we could almost rally around.
Just at that moment, a fellow programmer knocked at the studio door to ask for assistance. I'm going to pause once more, only just to... I realize I'm not actually using the phone, so I can actually help the gentleman that came in out. So just give me one more minute.
Sure.
Help the gentleman.
Thank you.
Help the gentleman.
Help the gentleman.
How do you guys think we're doing?
I don't know.
I have no idea. It might be a disaster.
I feel like every time I say something, I'm like, no, don't conclude that.
Yeah.
That's good.
Now, having come up dry, both at the courthouse with physical files, as well as digitally using Canly or the Canadian Legal Information Institute, it seemed to me that I was out of my depth. That in mind, I called a friend, former bandmate, former coworker named Jeff Hutchin, who is also a sole proprietor, a barrister, solicitor, and notary public located in Fredericton.
Can I give like a little disclaimer? Just that nothing that I'm going to say is going to be legal advice, and if they have any questions about specific offenses or anything like that, they should talk to a lawyer.
So you would have moved back just shortly before 2013. Do you remember this story?
I do, mostly because pretty sure I was like commuting to school at that time, listening to CBC every day, and it was just wild. It's just like a sort of like, oh yeah, I can definitely see that happening in New Brunswick.
you know, I mentioned this. I sort of went to the courthouse over the holidays in Fredericton and tried to find the case file, which truly was fruitless. And then I couldn't find it on Can Lee. The clerk couldn't find it. Now, is that typical? And if not, what does that say to you?
Okay, I bet you I know what happened. When you looked for the file, did you go downstairs and talk to someone?
No, it was sort of on the main floor. I turned right after the metal detectors.
Yep, so you talked to the Court of Queen's Bench clerk, and this would have been dealt with in provincial court. So you have to go downstairs and talk to them in room 105.
Okay, so I was certainly hedging around some sort of conspiracy around this case, but I think I was barking up the wrong tree. I asked Jeff to talk through certain aspects of the court process. Now, in addition to counts of theft and possession of cannabis at the time in 2013, of course, that was still illegal, Hashi was charged with breaching a court order that confined him to his native London, Ontario. Can you speak a bit to the court process with regard to charges like these?
Yeah, sometimes I think this is where sometimes reporters get confused, because I can't think of why someone would be confined to a particular city, but they could be confined to a particular address.
Like house arrest versus city arrest?
Or not even house arrest, just like you must reside at this address. And with that, there's usually two reasons. One is they want to make sure that they can find them if they don't show up for their next court date. And two is if they're receiving some sort of treatment, they have to live at that treatment center as part of their probation.
Okay. So you think it might have been something along those lines, potentially?
That would be the sad part of the story, right? Is if the guy had, like, some serious issues where he was trying to get treatment. But I don't, theoretically, that order should be part of the court file if you can get it.
Okay, so I'll need to do some more digging there. And you're absolutely right. That is sort of... I'm approaching this case that is like a local news story in a sort of like comedic way, but there might be a darker undercurrent. And until sort of, you know, ideally we track down Mr. Hashi or can kind of find more information from people close to him, that's sort of like the dark undercurrent, like the potential for that at least. That's Fredericton's The Olympic Symphonium with Cold and Blue. The potential for a darker undercurrent, as I called it, rambling to Jeff on that phone call, stuck with me for some days afterward. That only intensified when I confirmed the details of Mr. Hashi's sentencing. As a result of the theft, Judge Mary Jane Richards sentenced David Hashi to 4 months in jail. The Crown Prosecutor, in fact, had asked the court to impose a sentence of 3 to 6 months for the theft, plus an additional month for breaching recognizance, as well as a fine for cannabis possession. Judge Richards declined to fine Mr. Hashi, citing a lack of funds. The dock had been returned without damage or incident.
Carlo Reagan, hello.
Hi, Carlo. This is Brendan. How are you doing?
Good, Brendan. How are you?
Not too bad at all. Not too bad at all. Did I catch you at a good time?
Oh, well, yeah.
Beginning to realize the limits of citizen investigation, and now with a full 10 years between my criminology minor and today, I thought it best to consult a real professional on the topic. I spoke with Dr. Carla O'Regan from St. Thomas University's Criminology Department to unpack these charges and what they would have meant for Mr. Hashi.
Now, would you have been living in Fredericton when this happened in 2013?
Yes, that's the sort of interesting part about it. In fact, it's why I attribute it being noteworthy to me, because my partner and I had just purchased our home, and it overlooked the St. John River. I should have said the Willistically River. Mr. Hashi would have floated right by our house. So when we heard this about the news and everything, it was a great interest to us at the time, because we were rather enamored with all of the kind of river traffic.
Now, this was a pretty big news story in an otherwise quiet time of year. Would you hazard a guess as to what made the story so alluring to local media?
Oh, I think in a certain sense, there's something novel about it that I think many people kind of look at the river. Many visitors to the city sometimes ask how much river traffic there is. And there's also something kind of storybook nature about it. In fact, I think even one of the individuals from the rowing club characterized this as a bit of a Mark Twain or Huck Finn type of story. So I think there is a fairy tale nature to it. And I also think the water, the nature of it, just sort of draws people to it and imagines what it would be like to just float away.
Now, you mentioned a fairy tale aspect to things. I was hoping to talk with you maybe a bit more about a realist interpretation of the situation. I know a common theme in my interviews so far has been disbelief when interview subjects learn that Mr. Hashi was sentenced to jail time for this theft. Were you at all surprised to see incarceration as part of a sentence for a sort of caliber of crime or an extent of a crime like this?
Now, there's lots of interesting things about the way you phrase that question, in that there are many theft offenses for which I think people wouldn't be surprised or as judge the justice system as harshly for using incarceration. In this case, I suppose, was I surprised? No, but I, as always, wearing my criminology hat, I would be disappointed, simply because really prison and prison terms should be a last resort from a what works perspective. If what we care about is reducing criminal activity, then prison is really one of the least useful means of doing so.
Absolutely. I wonder if it's still common in your experience to see incarceration as part of sentences in crimes, both like this and also generally.
Yes, I think that it's sort of what happens when your criminal law is written by aristocrats and vested in the things that they value. It's the reason why property rights are attributed a much higher value in law, particularly the criminal code, than personal ones. And so there's a kind of an interesting value system there that's subject to scrutiny in terms of possession and profit, which is really at the heart of property offenses, being valued over something like personal autonomy. But from a strictly legal standpoint, theft tends to be punished rather harshly because people care about their stuff. And the criminal code creates the options for that. So the other thing that sort of would have been disadvantageous for Mr. Hashi in this case is the value of the item that he stole, which of course for him really didn't have anything to do with monetary value. But because the dock he stole was valued at, I think a news report listed it at $7,000.
That's right, yeah.
The criminal code divides punishments on the basis of theft based on the value of the item that's stolen. And the threshold level is $5,000. So if the value of the item you've stolen is less than $5,000, the maximum prison sentence that's available is 2 years. But if you steal something greater than $5,000, the punishment maximum period jumps up to 10 years.
And I find an interesting component of that is just the idea that the doc was returned, you know, no damage, unharmed.
Again, though, I would say you want to remember what the source of property law is. And it's about being able to have exclusive use to things and land and your property to the exclusion of all others. That's that very aristocratic kind of post-feudal folks wanting to hang on to their stuff and exclude others from it. Therefore, the theft is defined from a criminal standpoint as even just using something as your own or moving it. You don't even need to take it and permanently deprive the owner of it. You can just temporarily take it from them, and that's enough to violate these principles that where we care quite a lot about property. These are, of course, very different. I mean, they're colonial conceptions of property. You can imagine a very different approach to land and property use among, let's say, indigenous populations, where the notion of theft would be defined probably in a way that wouldn't necessarily incur penalty in Mr. Hashi's circumstances.
I asked Dr. O'Regan if she could speak to how the criminal justice system and incarceration affect people in these situations.
Oh boy, can I, if only we had time. yes, the truth is, as I said at the beginning, incarceration should be a last resort. It's not a place where people get healthy. It's not a place where, for the most part, useful skills are learned. This question goes back to what the purpose of punishment is. So if we view criminal activity as, let's say, a choice, which is a choice that someone makes either because, you know, it's an irrational choice, it's a poor choice, that in this case, Mr. Hashi chose to steal this item for any number of reasons. If that's the way that we understand criminal activity, then the way that we want to respond to it is usually on a pain-pleasure continuum. So that how do we make crime make less sense? Usually you impose some kind of punishment. The view here is if we understood Mr. Hashi's approach to have been a choice to commit a crime, then punishing him is a way of teaching him that choice was wrong. But if, however, you want to look at crime as, let's say, a condition of illness, then instead of punishing it, we really want to treat it. Or if you look at crime as a source of, let's say, inequality or social strain, then the way that you want to address it isn't necessarily by punishing or even treating the illness, let's say the offender. It's instead going to be about how do we change the social conditions that created the circumstances in which crime occurs. And I think when we hear about some of the personal characteristics about Mr. Hashi, the fact that he came from no fixed address, the court's decision not to impose a fine speaks to likely a low socioeconomic status. And I think some of the comments that were made to police upon his arrest, as well as in court during his bail hearing, suggest there may be some mental health issues. So really, when we think about all of these things, incarceration, it speaks to society's need to condemn and potentially seek vengeance or retribution. But deterrence as a punishment principle simply just doesn't work. That as much as we might want punishment to be as simple as, if this is a painful enough experience, he will learn the lesson not to do this again, there are really no criminological studies to prove that that's the case. In fact, all of the research that we do have shows the opposite, that when you have somebody who presents with, as for instance, you've characterized as you're not all that serious an offense, that when someone like that who has a relatively low risk on a violence scale is incarcerated and treated harshly by the criminal justice system, we tend to see a higher risk of recidivism or reoffending after they come out of an institution. You can imagine how different this would be if, as in many different places in the world, the notion of a punishment regime was around helping Mr. Hashi get some job skills or counseling, perhaps some substance abuse rehabilitation. All of these services might better address the public's ultimate goal of being safer from crime.
Revisitation will return after this.
Dad's in the kitchen listening to CBC, wondering if the jam let go, thinking maybe we should all move away. Well, he dons his boots and heads on out to check the creek. Well, she's rising faster now, out into the city street. That St. John's flooding, get out while you can. And I wonder how a river that is our friend turns its back on us again.
And if you were to hit a dead end doing those things, what would be the next step for you?
Yeah, then the next step is you hire like a process server.
And that would be like the person that we see sort of like sneaking in a disguise, asking somebody their name and then handing over a legal document in movies. So that'd be about right?
Yeah, it'd be like the guy from Pineapple Express.
Perfect.
But the funny thing is, like, I don't know how these guys find them. Like, it's unreal. It's just like they'll go and talk to like their neighbors. Oh, I think they're home from holidays on Friday. And they'll just like watch them come back from the airport.
Do you have a guy in a long trench coat and a bowler hat on retainer?
Yeah, that's St. John's flooding. But get out while you can. And I wonder how a river that is our friend turns his back on us again. So we load the truck and we drive away. Tomorrow brings yet another day. We'll be back home to stay. No more heavy prices to pay for another year the flood. It's gone away. Yes, that St. John's flooded. Look it out while you can. Our friend turns his back on us again. Yeah,
that's Tom Swift in his song, St. John River. We'll hear more from everyone in this episode a little further down the road. In the meantime, still unable to reach Mr. Hashi and now stalled by forces outside of my control, I decided to switch vantages to try and capture what he might have been seeing rather than thinking. All that and a whole lot more on the next episode of Revisitation. This has been Revisitation. In today's episode, you heard music from Wangled Temp, The Weather Station, The Olympic Symphonia, Tom Swift, Cedric Noel, Sam Arnold, and Brookside Mall. All of that music is tied to our story's setting, the Wolastoq River, often called by its settler name, the St. John. Revisitation was written and produced by me, Brendan McGee, with editing help from Dylan Ward, and thanks to Kyle Forbes, whose ancient PC this was made on. You can find full episodes, more info about the podcast, as well as links to stream and purchase these songs at revisitationpodcast.wordpress.com.